May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice. Justices, good morning. Paul Wallace on behalf of the appellant, the state of Delaware. This case is simple in the question that the state presents, not so simple to understand why we're here. This case does not involve the conviction of Mr. Petty. That's already been affirmed by this court in his intervening appeal of that conviction, which this court affirmed maybe close to a month ago now. There's also no question as to whether or not he was eligible for his habitual criminality. There was no question below. There is no question on that here, nor whether or not the state properly moved to have that habitual criminality applied, that status under 4214A, to the sentence for attempted robbery in the first degree. The only question is, what is that sentence? What should it be? The state argued at the time of sentencing that it should be, and not only did the state argue, the defense agreed. If you look at A74, the state, they said, please give the minimum. We understand what that minimum is. And then the prosecutor made his argument and said, we are asking for the minimum. That's 25 years. And then the judge said, I'm giving him three.
Help me understand what the current practice is with habitual offender petitions. Does the state exercise discretion in whether to seek that status?
Yes.
Okay. And the determination was made that this gentleman should be sentenced to the minimum of 25 years in the case.
Yes, Your Honor. And I mean, it is used during the plea process. It's used even after post-trial to determine what should be the appropriate sentence for him. And in this case, the state had moved to have his habitual status applied to the case that he went to trial for, attempted robbery in the first degree. That then moves the sentencing, the sentence guideline for him, or I should say the sentence, the statutory sentence, from 25, from 3 years to 25 years to 25 years to life.
And what are the reasons, if any, that the Superior Court could deny your motion?
Well, if in fact the state didn't provide sufficient evidence of the person's habitual criminality, if they either think of the case of Morales, for instance, where the court said, look, the state must prove the existence of each of those underlying convictions beyond a reasonable doubt. And certainly when the state has not satisfied that burden, that's one purpose or the one reason that it may be denied. But this court has held in no uncertain terms in cases like Kirby and Reeder that once the state initiates that process, if the statutory parameters are met, that it's not a discretionary finding and it's not a discretionary application.
Where did the trial judge come to the understanding that the maximum amount need not be given, as he states on the record?
I have no idea, Your Honor. There is no further explanation in the record. I simply do not know, and I cannot tell the court where that understanding came from.
What moved him to suggest that he wanted to complete the sentencing and you could move to modify it and brief that issue later?
Again, Your Honor, I don't know. The record is silent as to that. The prosecutor, in fact, what happened was both sides had given their sentencing presentations. The defense said, please give the minimum. The state said, the defense understands we're going to ask for the minimum. Please do so. Then the judge gave the sentence, read the sentence out as 3 years, and the prosecutor said, tried to correct the trial, the sentencing judge, and said, Your Honor, I don't, you can read A75 and 76. I don't believe that's correct. Laid it out as to why, and the judge said, I understand your position, but I just, and the two phrases that the court just mentioned, I don't believe I need to do that to a certain extent.
Mr. Wallace, hasn't the Superior Court distinguished convictions for an attempt to commit a crime and the actual crime itself in terms of handling them differently as to sentencing? I mean, doesn't Is it 531, which is the attempt statute, that that's a separate criminal offense, and therefore, since the attempt to commit a crime is not, at least way back when I was there, was not specifically listed in some other statutes that it would be treated differently?
Your Honor, I know that that was, I'll be delicate about this, a county-specific application sometimes in drug...
A county application?
It may have been that county, Your Honor. But I know that there was some theory.
That's why I'm remembering.
I know that there was some theory that in drug sentencings in particular, I had heard that sometimes people would get an attempted delivery on their second, and therefore the court would not have to give it the 15-year minimum mandatory that was applicable to drug crimes then. That, however, even that practice, even if that, if we laid all of those out, 531 says that an attempt is the same, is a crime of the same grade and degree, but more applicable in this circumstance when you talk about habitual criminal sentencing and the application of 4214A, and outside of drug sentencings and the attempted delivery situation, that's the only one I ever heard that you could perhaps not give a minimum mandatory if you had an attempted delivery. More importantly, in 4201C, it specifically says, well, 4214A says, if your fourth crime is a violent felony as defined by 4201C, and then you go to 4201C and it lists the violent felonies, and the very last thing it says in 4201C, the specific statutory language is, any attempt to commit any felony designated by this subsection as a violent felony, and robbery first is, shall also be designated as a violent felony. So for the purposes of the habitual criminal statute, even that distinction between attempts that had historically been made at times simply isn't applicable. 4201C says in no uncertain terms that an attempt is the same under that statute, and so when you plug it into 4214A, clearly that is the minimum, the 25 years is the minimum. I am at a loss, really, to explain the judge's rationale in this particular case.
Well, perhaps he was confusing it with the attempted delivery.
It was a Kent County judge sitting in Newcastle County. maybe that's what happened, but I don't know, Your Honor. And like I said, I had heard of that practice. In my practice, we did not see that very often, but I certainly had heard of it in drug crimes under the old drug code. I guess, put bluntly, that the court simply got it wrong here on the sentencing, and the prosecutor made the proper, filed the proper motion, made the proper argument. I know the defense, to this day, Mr. Petty still doesn't say, my sentence was legal. He says the state waived this when they didn't do what the judge asked and said, why don't you file a motion for modification? That doesn't make the sentence any more legal. What we would then do is go back under Rule 35A, which says an illegal sentence can be corrected at any time. When 9902F says the state has an absolute right to seek redress of an illegal sentence, that is the route taken here, rather than then having to file a motion, and then actually we'll be appealing whether or not the court acted correctly under Rule 35A as opposed to a direct route to this, the statutory language, which we believe is clear here. If there are no other questions from the court, I have no further presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I would like to challenge the state on the basis that I challenged the state in the defense briefing in this matter.
And that's a procedural challenge.
It's a procedural challenge.
And do you have a position with regard to the state's substantive argument?
Not really, because after all, the court did review this on a non-merit basis under Rule 26C, so it's uncomfortable for me to admit again that I couldn't do anything on behalf of my client with respect to his conviction and sentence, but I can't deny that. So this is a procedural challenge. And the procedural challenge is about how, and this is the point.
Is your answer that the state is correct on the substantive law?
I can't disagree with that on the substantive law. But there is a matter, it is of waiver, a principle that is...
I understand that, and I'll take your answer in being yes.
Yes.
Okay.
The procedural challenges on the way the Superior Court was treated under these circumstances. In essence, the state's argument is consistent with a scenario whereby they claim the absolute right, almost a divine right, to choose what they want to do, notwithstanding how a court should be treated. For example...
Well, I'm not sure I understand that. Let's hypothetically think of a civil case. There's a jury verdict, and the party disagrees with the jury verdict. The options are to move for a new trial, mm-hmm. set aside the verdict, additure, remittiture, a litany of options. Another option is simply take an appeal. Why is this different?
Well, it's a different situation because this matter was still says under consideration says by the Superior Court. This is...
Would the clock stop running on the time to appeal?
No, the clock would not stop running. The clock would stop running after 30 days, but I want to point out that the state had plenty of time to ask the Superior Court judge to reconsider. The state asked the Superior Court says to do that. The state had 30 days to do that. And on the 15th day, about the 15th day, the state decided to appeal the judge and show the judge he was wrong rather than let the judge in Superior Court decide the case. That would have been the civil thing to do with the judge.
Interpret this for me. The prosecutor says, may we reschedule this sentencing so the state may have an opportunity to brief it? And the judge says, no, I'd rather complete the sentencing here. And if a modification is necessary, then we'll do that. But I don't want to redo this whole thing if it's not necessary.
Correct.
What's the legal objection to filing an appeal rather than taking the option to move to modify the sentence?
The legal objection is based upon this court's rule, Rule 8. The state is claiming that it is an absolute right to take these, to take, make the decision it took here to upbraid the judge, to pull him up short, instead of asking the judge to reconsider a request which would not have prejudiced the state in any way. Not only could the state have given the judge 30 days to reconsider before taking an appeal, but if it had gone beyond the 30 days and the Superior Court denied a sentence modification, the state could appeal that and obtain full and fair review without being prejudiced one bit.
Well, your argument is one of, I suppose, etiquette and courtesy, but we have to address the legal issue, don't we?
Well, I see the court has to address the legal issue, but the court also has to address, I submit, says the etiquette issue. And part of what is subsumed under Rule 8 is that courts get treated as properly, as well as defendants, as well as the prosecution as parties.
Rule 8's premised on the theory that you have to raise the legal issue with the trial judge first before you can present it to us, and you have to demonstrate in the record where you've done that. Isn't that correct?
Yes.
What's missing from the record here in terms of raising the legal issue about the appropriate sentence?
What's missing is that the state did not give the court an opportunity to study the situation, to consider says what was going on. Obviously, there was a disjunct between what the judge was thinking and what the state was thinking. In fairness, the judge should have been given an opportunity to just walk out of the courtroom, to consult with his clerk, to consult with other judges, to consult with her before being brought by this court, brought before this court to be corrected by the state. This was all avoidable. It could have been avoidable had the state done what it should have done.
Help me understand why, when the trial judge said, I'm of the understanding that the maximum amount need not be given and I don't think it's appropriate in this case, why could he have said, well, let me go back into my chambers, consult with my law clerk, and I'll be back to you in 15 minutes.
He could have said that. However, there could have also been five or six attorneys waiting with other sentencing. We don't know. The record doesn't address that. You know, it's Superior Court, as I'm sure this court understands, is a dynamic situation. You know, every day when there's a session, and the judge balances.
I think he was confusing the attempted delivery scenario. Is there a background of that?
That yes, there was a background of that. And let me say, the state was a full participant in that. You know, in Kent County, you know, and it wasn't a defense ploy. The state was a full participant in that, in having people sentenced for attempts to non-habitual sentences when they would have been otherwise subject to habitual sentence or mandatory sentences.
How long ago was that?
A few years ago, probably 5 years ago.
Was this judge on the bench even then?
I don't know. I don't know, Your Honor. The, you know, there's a legal aspect to this, yes, and there's also a procedural aspect and a fairness aspect. This court's rule requires that issues be fully and fairly presented. I submit that this court has broad discretion insofar as determining what is fair. Certainly, I defer to members of this court, but to my mind, this is a court of law and equity, too. It's not like the Superior Court.
What would be the rule going forward, that the state must file a Rule 35 motion prior to appealing? What would be the...
No, that there doesn't have to be a rule. This situation is so unique and so exceptional that the rule applies to this case.
Only.
Yes, sir. We're not suggesting a situation whereby if the judge announces a sentence, and we've all been in that situation, and a judge announces a sentence or some other ruling, and you're wondering if the judge understood what you said, and you say, Your Honor, and the judge says, Counsel, I ruled. Now, we all know, you don't say anything more. And if you seek a remedy, you either file as a written request for relief before the judge, or you can seek an appeal. This is different circumstances. This is where this judge acted in complete good faith in dealing with the state, and he's getting the rug pulled out from under him.
Well, let's assume that we accepted your argument and that this is somehow a unique situation, and we, in effect, it's not the right term, but denied the appeal. What would happen?
What would happen? My client reduces 25 years on a sentence. And this wasn't a... And I'd like to point that out, too. One of the court's questions
well,
made
wouldn't,
that...
You want to talk about equity. Wouldn't equity be remand it, give the state an opportunity to do what you thought they should have done in the first place, which is to file a Rule 35 motion, and then once that's presented to the judge, how could he come to any result on the merits, or as Justice Allen put it, substantively, how could he come to any other result?
No, then the state would be in the same position, and there'd be no consequence for what the state did here, not fully and fairly presenting it to the trial judge. The court's, the...
Well, let me ask this. If we affirm, and the state, could they then file a Rule 35A?
I don't think so, because I think the court's ruling, you know, there's waiver. Waiver applies to the state as well as to the defense. And waiver, I would say, in some circumstances, an equitable doctrine. And this calls out for its equitable application under these exceptional circumstances. I mean, the judge here he's getting the rug pulled up from under him. And this is a judge who acted in complete good faith. And there is no reason for a judge being treated like this. In fairness, the state was obligated. They assume as the undertaking to say, Your Honor, I'll brief it. We'll submit something in writing. Had that happened, there easily could have been an understanding. Oh yes, well I see. Okay, I'm modifying the sentence.
And what sentence is your client currently serving?
3 years, Your Honor. And I'd suggest, as a matter of equity, if the court decides to apply its waiver doctrine under Rule 8, which this court has broad discretion, says to do, That's a fair sentence. This man had sentenced 2 burglary third degrees and a trafficking in cocaine. I think the burglary third degrees were breaking into cars. This was the first crime of violence against a person. And that point, the state's arguing that it's legally required to sentence him as an habitual offender. Well, that's not so, because he's not sentenced as an habitual offender unless the state decides in its discretion to ask for his sentencing as an habitual offender. And where the state has that sole, says discretion, and need not exercise it, I think the state should be bound by its waiver, or we think the state should be bound by its waiver under these circumstances. It's not legally mandated that if the state doesn't ask for habitual offender treatment, the Superior Court is obligated to impose an habitual sentence notwithstanding. That's an illegal sentence. The state's voluntary discretion is a part of this equation, and then when they waive it, it should be given effect. Different principles are presented here. Only questions fairly presented to the trial court may be presented for review. State takes the position that once sentenced, the state has an absolute right to file an appeal. If they have an absolute right and it's entities, what if the, when the Superior Court would not do what the prosecutor wanted the Superior Court to do at the time, and at trial, the prosecutor was acting in good faith and undertook a duty, says, towards the Superior Court to treat the Superior Court fairly. What if the prosecutor had just crossed his arms, looked at the judge, and walked out of the courtroom? Does the state have an absolute right to appeal? Has the state waived anything? That's a unique circumstance. We submit this is a unique circumstance. I recall, says, many years ago, I don't think it reached a written decision, but one of the judges in the Superior Court during an ongoing murder trial, there was an evidentiary ruling, I believe it was in the Perry case, and the prosecutors were mildly upset, to put it mildly, with the trial court's ruling, and they went back to their office at lunchtime, and they decided to seek an immediate writ of, I think, prohibition in this court, and started working on it. And they didn't show up at 2 o'clock when Superior Court was supposed to reconvene. And the trial judge, I recall the trial judge saying at perhaps a conference of other people, it got back to me that he'd never felt more insulted in his whole life. He could understand that they wanted to seek judicial review of his ruling because there may have been two different sides to it. But to not show up.
Well, there's a remedy for that, isn't there?
There is a remedy for that. But I don't think we need to go there. This is about this court's discretion under it, and this court is granted the judicial power, which is under the Constitution, and that judicial power has led to the court's establishment of and enforcement of certain principles like waiver, like fully and fairly presenting such issues. And that judicial power is not always circumscribed by what's in a statute. The court can exercise independent judicial power under unique circumstances. And we submit that this is a unique circumstance. If the court has no other questions, I'd be happy to.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Wallace, aren't there practical incentives to file a motion with the trial judge as opposed to directly appeal?
Yes, there are, Your Honor. And I stand up not to argue very much, but to talk more about the state's history of bringing appeals. I think if this court looked at the state's history of bringing appeals, one, we bring very few. Two, if you look at them, I know the very last one I argued here, State versus Abel. We did exactly what Mr. O'Donnell said, and that was, we filed a motion for re-argument. I do believe, as a practitioner, that most often you should give the trial judge the opportunity to correct an error first, if there's reason to believe that the trial judge is going to do it. The question becomes, motions for re-argument must be filed within 5 days. They don't always necessarily toll. If you look at some of the case law about whether they toll or not, for instance, Eller, as opposed to Dickens, there's a question as to that. Rule 35A, if you look at it, it really looks like a defense-related rule. The state, it's not very clear that the state can bring that motion to correct, although in Reeder versus State, this the court did uphold the Superior Court's correction of that habitual sentence. So while it's very easy for Mr. O'Donnell to say, well, the state could have just done this, this, and this, I am not any less lawyer than anyone else. And I must ensure on behalf of my client that I take what is the best option. And when there is a statute that says when a judge imposes an illegal sentence, you have an absolute right to appeal, I am sure that procedurally I am on firm ground, as opposed to bringing, for instance, a questionable Rule 35A motion, questionable in the procedural sense, or a motion for re-argument that may not toll the time. I can sweep away those. I'd suggest respectfully that the state does treat Superior Court. I made the decision to appeal this case. You can see my name on the notice of appeal. I will stand here on my own merits and my own reputation as to my courtesy to courts. This was not a discourteous move to the court. It was a belief that that was the best procedural avenue for the state, and that there was nothing more to be made in the record below, quite honestly, because the court said, I understand your argument here, and that the state had laid out its argument appropriately. I doubt. And notice how Mr. O'Donnell really wants the cabinet to this case, because most often he sits on that side. I doubt that he wants a rule that says, unless you file a motion for re-argument, you've waived. The state waived nothing. None of the waiver rules apply here. And the court and the state certainly was not showing any discourtesy to the Superior Court. In fact, you can see in the record, the prosecutor asks, after the judge takes this, can we please brief this? And it's the judge who says, no, I want to do this now. The problem is once he did that, it became a final order, and the clock started ticking, and then we had to decide what's the best avenue. I don't think that the state should be held accountable.
To have done it now, because he traveled up to Wilmington, and everybody had assembled.
But to file another motion is going to prolong the proceedings down there. There may be many reasons that the court wanted to do it then. But to try to meld some waiver argument that the state, because of some discourtesy, should not be able to enforce the statutes that have been put in place when everything was done properly. And in fact, I think the prosecutor asked the appropriate remedy when the judge said, no, I'm going to do it now, and asked, can we brief this? I think the court's incorrect here. Certainly, this court should not hold, even in this unique case, that waiver can be applied when the party did fairly present its all of the predicates to the habitual criminal sentence. And then, even at the time that it believed an illegal sentence was, asked for the court not to enter that final order. The court entered the final order, and then the state had to make procedural decisions in this case. The procedural decision in this case was 9902F was the best avenue to ensure the state's position.
Am I correct that it was the trial judge that spoke in terms of a modification and the prosecutor that simply spoke in terms of rescheduling or a euphemism for continuing the sentence until there was an opportunity to brief the issue?
Yes, Your Honor.
So the state made no representation that they would seek to file a Rule 35 motion?
I think at the very, very end, the prosecutor may have said, well, then would said something to the effect of briefing. But once the judge had said you can file a motion or do something, I believe that may have been said.
The prosecutor says, may we reschedule this sentencing so the state may have an opportunity to brief it, and the trial judge says, no, I'd rather complete the sentencing here, and if a modification is necessary, then we'll do that. But I couldn't find where the state offered to file a motion.
I believe, may I step away for a moment, Your Honor, because I believe thereafter, I don't want to leave the court with a misimpression that there was some, wasn't some
well, if
discussion by that from the prosecutor.
Well, if there's some discussion about a modification, it would have come after the trial judge said no.
Yes.
We're going to sentence now.
Yes. The prosecutor attempted to say, well, then, Judge, can I please make my record here now? You know, this is why I believe your sentence is illegal. It may have been on A76. Mr. Grubb at the very end. For down the road, which would then make Mr. Petty subject to the minimum period of incarceration, 25 years, with the maximum being life, but I understand the court's ruling and position, and the state will submit briefing. But that was at the very end of the sentencing, so.
Okay.
That's as close as he comes to saying that.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.
Please rise.